Okay, yes.
What is the evidence that would prove that the parcel weren't lying?
Yeah, question is, what's the evidence to show that the apostles were not lying? This is a very good question, because you're faced with only certain alternatives if you don't take this material as representing historical fact. If this stuff doesn't represent historical fact, then clearly somebody was either engaged in an intentional or an unintentional deception. I'm going to broaden the question to unintentional deception also. Let's say, what is the evidence that these people were not either lying or so wound up in their religious convictions that they were willing to put this stuff down even though it didn't happen? The best evidence that they were not lying is the fact that these documents are known to have been in circulation, as I mentioned a little while ago, when hostile factions were around wanting to crush the thing. And these hostile factions did not provide evidence to counter this. Now you say, isn't this an argument from silence? Well, not exactly. The major attempt to dump this whole business while Jesus was alive was made by his co-religionists. Not the Jews as a general category, for goodness sake, but certain Jewish religious leaders, the religious leaders represented by the Pharisees and the Sadducees primarily. The Zealots didn't get in on this very much because they were interested in blowing up everything. And so they were sort of indiscriminate in their attitude toward this sort of business. Now, we have quite a number of documents from this period that arose in the Jewish theological community. These records were passed on in the Jewish community even after the dispersion, the diaspora, after the fall of Jerusalem in 70, and they were kept in the Jewish communities through the Middle Ages. Thus, it's just impossible to say that there was evidence against this. And these religious leaders attempted to preserve it, but they were unsuccessful because all of the nasty Christians came along and destroyed the evidence. The fact is that the religious leaders were quite well able to preserve their materials, and we have these materials to a very large extent. What we don't have is any refutory material on this. We have some nasty things said about Christians later on, but we don't have anything that is said about this particular material. Now, it's very peculiar that when there was such a great interest in getting rid of this particular sectarian notion, this Christian sectarian notion, that nothing was done to deal with this fundamental claim. If Christ had not had simply died at Jerusalem, been crucified at Jerusalem, and had remained in the tomb, why is it that there isn't anything on the subject? If the people who wrote this stuff had lied, then they would have gone directly against the moral code that they claimed to be following. Jesus was very strong on the matter of lying being wrong. There is one little encounter that he had with some people, and he said, "You are of your father the devil. He was a liar from the beginning, and so are you." Now, it seems awfully strange that people would attempt to follow somebody who was so much against lying, and that they would turn right around and do this themselves. Jesus was also against using the end to justify the means. So, for these people to have created a resurrection in order to emphasize the personal relationship that they had with him, this sort of thing, is, again, to go directly against his teachings. And why would they have preserved his teachings in that regard if they were actually going against them? Now you can say, ah, weren't they clever to have done that? They did that just to trick us, see? But if you say this, then this arrives at what is known these days as analytical absurdity. What would convince you, you see, if any point of evidence is just an indication of how clever they were in their deception, then it's perfectly obvious that there couldn't be any evidence that would deal with the question, in which case the argument is nonsensical. As to their being off in the noggin, the problem with this is the character of these writings. Hardly anybody has seriously maintained that the authors of these documents were off. The documents are just too lucid to arrive at this conclusion. Yeah.
What is the evidence of the documents of the writing of the where can it be found?
Yeah, these are collected Talmudic sources and commentaries on the Talmud, and they are available in any number of different editions. The material is massive, and it depends upon what material you're looking for. The thing to do if you want to get into this sort of thing is to go to any Jewish theological seminary library, and there are special bibliographical approaches to this stuff, so my advice is that you talk with a professional librarian there. Otherwise you will find yourself utterly engulfed, and some of this material is not available in good English translations. There's more of it translated into German than there is into English. Let me see. I guess we'll go up here. Yeah.
The New Testament mentions that after the resurrection, the Pharisees or the Jewish leaders tried to circulate the story that the disciples had stolen Christ's body. Is this particular interpretation found within the extant Jewish literature itself?
There are a couple of references to this. But if the question really is, what are the chances of that having happened? Which I suppose would be the question of widest interest, this comes back to the point that we made a couple minutes ago. If these people had actually stolen the body, see, and then they had gone ahead and put into the record that their opponents suspected that they were going to do this, and therefore set up a preventative measure, then you see this turns into a kind of James Bond operation. See? And the question is, can you actually read this material and regard this as a consistent picture of these people? Is this the kind of person that that Matthew was, for example? In the materials themselves, is this consistent with the personalities that you come across? Very difficult to say this. Can I stop you right there? If you wouldn't, why not?
Well, because the.
I mean, what evidence do you have in these documents that any of these writers would engage in that kind of second level deception?
Well, I said that.
No, I thought you said I wouldn't go quite that far.
I said I wouldn't go that far in saying, you know.
Oh, I see. I got that the other way around. Okay.
Right.
All right.
But I think that still they would be quite capable of self-deception on two grounds. One, you said that the writings are so lucid that you wouldn't believe the same thing. It's fairly obvious that you understand that the writings. And yet, one would not say that Luther, for example, or most of the early fathers were insane. They wrote many very lucid things, and yet they claim to be all sorts of devils. And most of us, I think, would be inclined to, or many of us at any rate, would be inclined to doubt what they thought, that they were hallucinating or imagining.
Well, you see, that's the question here is, can't we say that perhaps these writers are hallucinating a bit? Because look at people like the patristic writers who thought they were seeing devils, and people like Luther who said that he did, and so on. Well, you see, this is exactly the question. how well do we know the universe? I mean, do we know the universe well enough that if a person otherwise sane says that he has had a particular kind of experience, that we say, well, that's obviously wrong. He has not had that kind of experience, and therefore at that point he's hallucinating. For example, I'll give you a modern case of this kind. Joris Karl von Huysmans, the writer of La Bas, and Ah Hobu, the founder of the modern flashback technique in the French novel at the end of the 19th century. He was involved in occult and satanic circles in the 1890s, and he described certain things that happened there. And the fellow who was began as an atheist ended up as a Christian, as a Catholic Christian. And he said that he was driven to this because he discovered that spiritual reality was very definitely there negatively, and he needed a great deal of positive help because, by George, they were after him. Now, what do you do in a case like this? Personally, I have kind of a naive view of the universe in the following sense. I don't think I know a great deal about it. It's a vast and mysterious place, and in the unit that we engaged in here on time travel, I tried to point out some of the amazing considerations that apparently operate. Under these circumstances, do we have a tight enough, closed enough view of the universe that we can say that people are hallucinating when they say that they've had experiences of this kind? Well, all right. Now, if you can't say, if you, wait a minute now, not being able to say is not the same thing as doubting, is it?
No, if you don't know, you don't know.
Well, no, look, the question is, does the burden of proof rest upon me to show that something can't happen? Or does the burden of proof rest upon somebody else to present evidence in behalf of the particular event? It seems to me that I am at a total loss to be able to present enough evidence about the universe to rule out events. I just don't see how I could possibly do this. Thus, if a person otherwise sane says that he saw a particular thing happen, seems to me I've got to give at least sufficient credence to this to check it out, to see, for example, if this material is primary source evidence, to see if there is external confirmation, if other people say the same thing, and so on.
Well, but then it's a matter of self-perception. I think it was Ambrose who talked about a lie and a good cause being all right. You know, the idea being that...
Do you find any of these New Testament writers saying that?
If you're sure of the truth, well, presumably he didn't either. So why would he come up with the doctrine being a Christian? I'm saying.
Wait. Even in my weakened condition, I cannot possibly take that. In the first place, because Ambrose said that a lie and a good cause is a good thing, and I personally would very much like to see the context of that, because I have a grave suspicion that is somewhat removed from context. But even if Ambrose were simply saying hooray for lying and a good cause, it would not follow that he was saying this because he was a Christian. See, there have been people in the history of Christianity who have said a lot of things, even though they themselves were Christian, which do not necessarily derive from this. There are a lot of right-wing reactionaries out here in California who are also Christians, but I do not believe that their right-wing reactionary statements derive from their Christianity, even though they may think that this is the case. But the important thing is whether these New Testament writers ever even suggested that lying in a good cause was proper. And I say they didn't. You can't find a trace of this in their writings.
But what I'm saying is that presumably, he didn't find it inconsistent with Christian teaching to say that. I mean, he could justify.
But did these people say anything like this, or did they attempt to justify any such thing?
Well, what I'm saying is that it's possible that they might have figured, well, we know the truth of this, but to some people it's going to be incredible. Therefore, let's, you know.
Oh, Of course that's possible. It's also possible that the entire group consisted of Martians who came down here dressed in Jesus suits and apostle suits, and they were so cleverly disguised that nobody could tell the difference. Look, anything is possible except putting toothpaste back into a tube, as some philosophers have said. And the question isn't what's possible. The question is, what is plausible in terms of the actual historical evidence you've got? Now, suppose you attempted to use that same kind of reasoning in relation to events in the life of Napoleon. Why, your history professor wouldn't stand for that sort of thing for 2 seconds. Because you can't say it's possible that Napoleon never existed but was actually simply a figurehead put up by a hidden directorate, this sort of thing, and have that mean anything.
Well, then for a concrete example of what seems to be a sort of disingenuous bring probably some sort of self-deception in that as it's trying to impress. In math, we have on the one hand a list with the genealogy at the beginning showing Christ's ascension date to show that one prophecy is being fulfilled, the Messiah.
You state this as if you think he set it up in order to prove something, rather than describing what was actually the case. What gives you that idea?
Well,
don't you feel a person ought to be given the benefit of the doubt unless he can be proved guilty?
Then he mentioned the version, the doctrine of the virgin birth, and the quote, that it was fulfilled that he had accepted
the virgin
child. Right. Now, completely contradictory. They would be to any Jew because you would regard this descent that came through the male line. You know, and, well, obviously Matthew did too. He traced the descent through Joseph, who obviously was not the father of Jesus.
Okay.
The whole Joseph was the father of Jesus. Therefore, the Messiah was not descended from David, and a prophecy goes well. But Matthew.
But listen, my dear fellow, all that is attempted there is to show that legally and officially Jesus is related to the proper Jewish tribe. And that was the case. Under the law, Jesus' legal father was Joseph. See? Why does this pose any problem? See, it seems to me, now maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me you're creating difficulties for the text. I think Aristotle was quite right in the Poetics when he took people to task who went into the study of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey and attempted to point out all of these inconsistencies and difficulties and problems and so on. Aristotle said, look, the critic must not arrogate the central position to himself. The critic must give the benefit of the doubt to the text and try in the best fashion to see what the text says and provide the text with the maximum say. Now, it may be that in doing this, you'll find that a text is screwy, you know, that it's off base, that it's inconsistent, and so on. But that ought to be the last resort in dealing with it. Now, problems of this kind, the kind that you raise with the genealogy, are problems that have been dealt with much less painfully on the basis of holding to the text as historically reliable. Well, what I want to know is what makes your suggestions significant in handling this. I mean, why the fact that it's possible for a thing to be the case doesn't mean that it's that ought to be accepted as the more probable or plausible approach. You see, what you're doing is arguing things in the face of the documents rather than arguing them on the basis of the documents. When you say that the people may very well be lying, sure, it's possible, but where's the evidence that they were doing so? You know, or not lying, but fudging it.
One thing I'd like to know with regard to what is the basis for the story of Christ's birth? Because he never says anything about the Annunciation or his virgin birth and that.
Yeah, okay. The question is, why go along with the virgin birth since Jesus himself didn't say anything about it? Well, fact of the matter is, if you look in the autobiographies of people, They do not always give a description of their own birth. If you've got a description of somebody's birth coming from somebody who had immediate contact with a person's parents, then it's generally considered that that's a reliable picture of what actually happened. And in the case of these materials, they were written by apostles, and Jesus' own mother was in this same community. You see?
The point is that...
I mean, let me turn it around. What gives you the idea there's anything the matter with it?
Well, the point is that it's a magnificent phenomenon. Presumably, great many people were aware of it when it happened.
Oh, really? You mean those shepherds?
The shepherds came.
Then when the shepherds had their annual shepherds' convention, Yes, definitely.
Obviously. People
definitely.
Know when word was spread elsewhere, and people would have some sort of remembrance of this thing when Christ, you know, came apparently from out of nowhere and started teaching. Why didn't you mention it? What had happened?
Well, it's mentioned in two out of the four gospel accounts that are the primary.
When he preached to people, say, remember, you know, that star and all that stuff.
Well, I have no idea. I have no idea. What makes you think that he ought to have mentioned this?
Because presumably it had some sort of significance in his life. I mean, he was born.
See, look, you see, what we've got to do is to base our conclusions here as to what, you know, what ought to have been done, etc., etc., on the historical evidence as to what was the case. Now, if you find somebody who doesn't provide the kind of presentations that you think he ought to, then there are two possible explanations. Either there's something the matter with him or there's something the matter with you. And it might just be that Jesus had a reason for this. I can suggest a reason, though we're arguing in the area of the unknown. My suggestion is that the stress he wanted to place was on his death for the sins of the world and his resurrection, and the balance of material in these Gospels would support this. For example, almost in the case of the earliest Gospel, the Gospel of Mark, almost 50% of this Gospel deals with the last week of Jesus' life. And you find a proportionate emphasis on the last week of Jesus' life in the other Gospels. Everything is leading up to this. Perhaps the reason is that Jesus didn't want people to look backward. He wanted them to look forward, because the purpose of his coming was, after all, not to be a baby. The purpose of his coming was to die as a ransom for many, as he said. This is only a suggestion, but we would get into a lot of trouble historically, I think, if we would say, for example, in the case of Demosthenes' orations, now, such and such an event occurred during Demosthenes' time. What's the matter with him? Why didn't he mention it?
Well, that's a presupposition that we have all the words of Jesus Christ down. It never says that. He might very well have mentioned that fact. You're making a presupposition without any evidence whatsoever on that.
I'm saying there is no record.
Fine.
Yes, that's right.
But as far as, you know, you were talking about all these...
He also didn't say anything about his growing up, for example. There's no mention that he worked in a carpenter shop by him, personally. Do you think that he probably didn't work in a carpenter shop?
I don't know. But you said something about
Notice that I also mentioned Thucydides, the historian.
But, well, as far as that goes, have you ever studied, for example, Porto's and Folio's of Shakespeare? How marvelously they managed to garble these things in here?
As a matter of fact, I have, and they don't. There are minor textual differences, but these textual differences very definitely do not go to the heart of the material, so that you can argue that the thrust of Macbeth is in doubt as a result of textual considerations. The work of people like Fredson Bowers in the lower criticism, the textual criticism of Shakespeare, is as good an evidence as anything you could possibly have of the reliability of this textual tradition.
Well, there's a difference between trust and, for example, specific moral commands. Like in one gospel, we're told that no divorce is permissible. In another, we're told that it is in the case of adultery. You know, so there's a difference there. Would that be a textual error, or did you agree, or what?
What do you think a logical contradiction is? Well, do you really think it's a contradiction when a person makes a statement on one occasion without qualifying it and makes the same statement on another occasion and does qualify it?
I never said it was a contradiction. I said, you know.
No, but I think you suggested that there was something the matter with the text because of this.
I said they were certainly different, and they were, as I recall, about same incident, and they reported what Christ said.
Would you be willing to bet your last dollar that they are the same incident? Yeah. The fact of the matter is that the except for the cause of adultery is presented as a qualification of in one gospel. See, it is not presented in another gospel, but this is no more a contradiction or a textual problem than when a speaker on one occasion makes a general statement and then on another occasion, because of particulars in the situation, qualifies this. It doesn't mean that he's contradicting what he said on the previous occasion at all. It simply means that he is adding to or further explicating what he said on the previous occasion.
But this isn't a further explanation, because, you know, he's saying different things. Under one circumstance, no divorce is possible at all.
Well, to bring this kind of to a halt so I can get in some other questions, I think what you're doing is to apply a method to these materials that you wouldn't for the life of you apply to anything else. You would not use this kind of approach in handling material dealing with other historical characters, because if you did, you would end up with a tissue of possibilities which would give you absolutely no firm knowledge of anything. Now, I'm not saying that the evidence for this is 100%. There is no 100% evidence for any historical matter. I'm simply saying that if you don't want to go along with the plausibilities on the basis of this kind of textual evidence, then you've got to see the repercussions of this in working with other material. And I've noticed in discussing this with people that there is a tendency to apply a very specialized kind of criticism when it comes to these materials. And I think I know why. Now, I'm not particularizing this to you because this may not apply to you, but I notice that people get very antsy when it comes to the validity of this stuff. Why? Because if this were really the case, it would necessitate a transformation of the person's life. His life could not remain as it was before, because he would have to move out of the center, and this Christ would have to move into the center. So there is better reason for engaging in severe criticism of this stuff than there is for engaging in severe criticism of Napoleonic material, for example. I don't know whether this is the case, but I suggest that anybody who finds himself using a technique here, which he finds very difficult to use elsewhere, should ask himself why he's doing this. Why don't we give the benefit of the doubt to this material as we do with other material? Now, sometimes the reason for this is that it contains miraculous stuff. You mentioned the virgin birth of Christ, that is, of course, a miraculous kind of affirmation. Now, next week we're going to talk about this and see what we can say about this issue of the miraculous. Maybe that's the problem. But surely we don't want to be fundamentalists in reverse by insisting that a special method be used for this material which we wouldn't apply to anything else. Fundamentalists are frequently criticized for taking an exceedingly holy view of this material so that you can't even investigate the evidence in behalf of it. There is, however, a kind of reverse fundamentalism which deals with this material in a fashion which is so negatively critical that we simply wouldn't use it in relation to anything else. I'm saying let's look at this stuff as we look at other historical material and see what the results are.
Well, if we use shoddy methods of examining other material, it doesn't make any more valid to use the same shoddy method to examine this. I'm not saying, we could argue about this.
Are you saying that the methods of bibliographical internal and external tests are shoddy, or aren't you? Are you saying that the bibliographical internal and external tests of the validity of a document are shoddy or are not shoddy?
Well, what I'm saying is that you
excuse me, but we got to move on. Shoddy or not?
Well,
then be sure that you emphasize this in the next history course you take, because those are the methods that are employed in dealing with all other historical data. And these have been developed on the basis of very, very careful work in the methodology of the historical sciences. Maybe all of these people are nuts, but I would prefer to think that they do know what they're doing. Okay? Excuse me, can you make it a little louder? I can't hear you.
He said that concerning the possibility of self-attention of the Bible that are in there telling the story, he said that the devil, the Luther, etc., who fell up front by might exist. But aren't there, there are occasions where religious beliefs say that apparently through divine revelation, direct conscience. For example, many of the churches today believe that they're the true church. And you can't believe them all.
The question here really is, merely because miracle claims are made, can we automatically assume that these are okay? We can't, of course. And what I'm concerned with is to have these claims checked out on the basis of the kind of historical methods that are generally employed and that we've been talking about tonight. We're not saying that any time anybody comes along and says, ho, ho, there is a purple giraffe in my backyard and I ride him nightly, that we are to assume that there is such a purple giraffe. We're not here presenting the notion of any claim automatically holding up, but we're saying that if claims are presented and they have internal and external attestation, then are we in a position to knock these? And this means an ad hoc approach has to be taken to such matters. We can't assume either that they're all valid or that they're all invalid. We start with the investigation of a particular problem, see, and we see what the results are, and then we go on from there. Now, these various claims that are made within Christendom in behalf of particular churches, it seems to me, constitute a secondary question. Why? Well, because if the resurrection of Christ did not occur, then there's no sense in bothering with the rest of these, because these claims are direct, I mean in terms of their religious significance, because these claims are directly bound in with the validity of Christianity as such, so that any of the people you're talking about would be the first ones to say, presumably, that one ought to begin by an investigation of the very kind of problem that we've been dealing with tonight. I'm not in the business of resolving those claims particularly. I'm, as you know from the other course that I'm giving, I'm concerned with the historic Christian faith as set out in the ecumenical creeds of the Church, the Apostles, the Nicene, the Athanasian creeds. These are held in common by Eastern Orthodox, by Roman Catholic, and by Protestant Christians. I'm not here to arbitrate among denominational views. That's great indoor sport. I happen to be a member of a denomination myself. You could probably get me on this if you pressed long and hard enough and in a different context, but I don't feel that that's my function here. Yeah.
you elaborate further on the pirate findings that dated back to the
Yes, the question is, can I elaborate further on the papyrus findings? Maybe what I ought to do, because of the limitations of time, is to give you a reference or two on this. If you check under Kenyon's name in any major library catalog, probably here at UCSD, you will find his summary, his volumes on textual evidence, and there are generally there's generally at least a chapter devoted to the papyrus question itself, if not more. Now, the papyrus fragments are listed and they are numbered, and there is a special designation for these, a lowercase p followed by a subscript number, and these run on, and each of these fragments is discussed as to its dating and the basis for the dating. The dating is generally handled on the basis of paleography, the handwriting employed, though to some extent there is scientific testing of the papyrus itself in terms of the date of the material. Also, the standard critical edition of the Greek Testament is the edition under the name of Nestle, N-E-S-T-L-E, with the Latin title Noum Testamentum Graeci, and there is a long introduction where the major papyrus fragments are discussed as to date, and then in the critical apparatus at the foot of the pages of text, wherever a papyrus fragment bears directly on the meaning of the text, it's cited. Yes. Yeah, the question is, how historically valid is the Quran in comparison with this? Well, that can be answered very readily. There were a number of variant manuscripts of the Quran, but the early caliphs decided that this would be a deterrent to faith. So all of the variants were arbitrarily burned, leaving only one text. Therefore, there is absolutely no textual problem with the Quran. You have only one text. The only trouble is that it's impossible today to determine the validity of this text because you can't relate it to any other texts. This was a convenient way of solving the problem, and a person who works in that area does not have to worry about textual criticism in the slightest. Yes? I wonder if that's the that's one of the John Rylands papyri, and that's I believe it's P51 or P52. I don't have my Nestle here with me. P52, yeah. I'm not terribly good at remembering numbers, and if I'm off a papyrus, don't kill me. In a medieval history lecture that I gave the other day, I discovered to my horror that I had given the death date of Thomas Aquinas as 1250 instead of 1274, and that was the death date of Frederick II, you see. So, I mean, this kind of thing happens. Yes?
I'd like to wait my place for the lady down there so she can hear the
knowledge. You are a gracious gentleman, my goodness. Makes me think I'm back in France. Where is the... Yes, all right. Yeah, this is a question about the Apocrypha. There are two groups of Apocrypha, the Old Testament Apocrypha and the New Testament. The Old Testament Apocrypha appear in Roman Catholic editions of the Bible and in some Protestant Bibles, but collected at the end. Never were part of the Hebrew Bible because we don't have any Hebrew texts of them. They appeared first in the Greek translation of the Old Testament that was done in Alexandria between about 300 and 100 BC. This is known as the Septuagint translation, and when Saint Jerome began translating, he first employed the Septuagint, and therefore these made their way into the Latin Vulgate. The fact is that they were not in the Bible that Jesus used, because the Bible Jesus used was Hebrew with Aramaic paraphrases, and these books were never in those languages. Now, there's nothing the matter with them at all. They're delightful and have some very interesting material about the period between the Testaments. But in general, even among Roman Catholics, they are not put in the same class of writings as the other Old Testament materials. As far as the New Testament Apocrypha are concerned, these are not put in the Bible by anybody, and the reason for this is that they can readily be dated as very late and therefore not involving primary source historical material. I'm glad you raised this, because it's important to reemphasize what I said early in this class period, that the stuff that you get in the New Testament is not put there to separate it from historical analysis. It's put there because the early church analyzed the provenance, the origin of these materials, and came to the conclusion that these were the materials that were the primary sources, you see. In other words, what you've got in the Bible is a kind of library, in the New Testament, a library of the primary sources dealing with Jesus. Now, there are other materials that have to do with Jesus in some sense of the word, but those materials are not as reliable historically, and the New Testament Apocrypha are some of the most unreliable materials. The best edition of the New Testament Apocrypha, if you'd like to read them, is the edition edited by M.R. James. M.R. James. There is a more recent edition in a later translation by Bruce Metzger. But M.R. James's edition is the better scholarly edition of them. M.R. James, by the way, is one of the greatest ghost story writers in the English language. He did that on the side. I'll just mention this. If you like ghost stories, you'd enjoy getting into them from that angle. But he was a professor and scholar as a
in his career. Now, in the translations in English of what Jesus called himself, the Son of Man, the Son of God, we can use these terms to refer to ourselves. Now, did Jesus come out to specifically say, I am God?
Yes, he did. He said, I and the Father are one. And when Philip said, show us the Father, Jesus said, have I been so long with you, Philip, and you have not known me? He who has seen me has seen the Father. The charge that was put against him was the charge of blasphemy. He was crucified on the basis of the charge of blasphemy. Now, if you take statements such as those I just quoted, or you take this matter of his forgiving sins, and they said, who can forgive sins but God only? And Jesus did not refute this. It's clear why this charge arose. And it seems to me that the people of his time, the Orthodox religionists of his time, had only those two choices. Either the man was a blasphemer, or he was who he claimed to be. They saw this very clearly. Now, we today try to fudge this. We say, well, now, he obviously had such fine moral teachings that we can't consider him a blasphemer. On the other hand, we don't want to consider him God, because that would mean that we'd have to come into the kind of relationship with him that he demanded. So we try to find some intermediate position, which is the Boy Scout, the ideal Boy Scout, trotting around Galilee, helping little old ladies and so on. But this is utterly unhistorical. You just can't do it. Jesus himself said something about he would prefer people to be either hot or cold. The lukewarm would be spewed out of the mouth. At least these religionists of his time saw the issue clearly. You can't sit on the fence on this. Incidentally, the term Son of Man, which to a lot of people since the time of Protestant liberalism has seemed to indicate a representative man, sort of a good Joe, actually derives from the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 7 verse 14, which is one of the highest apocalyptic passages in the Bible, where it says that the Son of Man shall come on the clouds of heaven with all the heavenly host. And when Jesus cited this passage before the high priest, when he was brought to trial, the high priest rent his garments and said, we have no need for any further witnesses. He blasphemes, take him away. The high priest immediately recognized that if Jesus applied that passage to himself, that meant that Jesus was claiming to be the divine manifested here on earth. So that expression cannot be taken to mean representative man in the sense of good old Joe. Yeah.
What is the critics of the biblical account of the resurrection say happened to the body in the store play if it wasn't there?
Yeah, maybe the tape recorder got that. Did you get that tape recorder? If you didn't, the question is, what do the critics of this say was done with the body of Christ? To tell you the truth, the trouble is the critics sideswipe this because if you don't say that the body of Christ rose, that Christ rose, you've got to say that either the Romans stole it, or the religious leaders stole it, or the disciples stole it, or somebody who had no interest in the situation stole it, huh? Well, it seems rather unlikely, you know, that there were just body snatchers around, sneaking bodies, considering the fact that Jesus' crucifixion was a major event of the Passover, the central festival of the Jewish religious year, and people knew about it. The Romans obviously wouldn't have stolen the body, because what they were interested in doing at all costs was to keep things quiet in Palestine and in other such minor provinces of the empire. Pilate wanted this whole thing hushed up at all costs. He wanted it all over and done with. In fact, he allowed Jesus to be crucified simply in order to cut down on the fuss. The Jewish religious leaders obviously didn't want to remove the body because the claim had been made by Jesus that he would rise from the dead. So that would bring it down again to the disciples, and we've discussed that. A scholar by the name of Morrison, Frank Morrison, back in the 1920s, started out in an investigation to prove that Jesus did not rise from the dead. And as a result of checking out all of this evidence, he became a Christian. And he wrote a book, which is, it's been in print ever since, entitled Who Moved the Stone? Who Moved the Stone? This is published by the British firm of Faber and Faber. It's in a paperback. That is exactly the consideration that brought him to the conclusion that the Christian faith was valid, that there was no explanation for what happened to this, that the best historical explanation is the explanation given in these primary documents. All right, I think we'll terminate at this point. It's already 10 after 10. Remember that there is a discussion each week, a general discussion taking place at the home of Dr. Frank Young, and the address is now being stuck upon the board. And so if you have questions on this, or you want to discuss this sort of thing further, my suggestion is that you come over. This is very, very close to the university, just off of Torrey Pines Road, isn't it? Yeah, very just off of Torrey Pines Road. So if you feel suppressed or repressed or something like that, please do feel free to come over, and I hope I'll have more of a voice by next Tuesday.